Thanks, Bill. My name's Neil Fackley. I'm an alcoholic. Hey, everybody. It really is kind of exciting to be here. Cliff is a hard act to follow, you know. And I do believe he belongs on the spiritual part of the program. One of the early definitions I heard of spirituality was, or of enlightenment, was to lighten up. And we need a little bit of laughter. In our drinking days, our using days, and in my case for several years thereafter, there wasn't a whole lot of laughter. We're making up for it now, you know. And a lot of definitions about spirituality, a lot of things that I could say about it, but I think what I want to emphasize most this morning is that everybody in this room is already spiritual. And don't ever think otherwise, because if you were not spiritual, you would not be here. You know, when I was growing up, we didn't grow up in a religious home, and I had no idea about the God thing, and I had no idea about spirituality. My folks were good people and taught us values and all that, and I always thought I was missing something because I didn't have tools to live by. You know, I never felt like I fit in anywhere. I never felt like I understood what was going on. And I always felt that I was left out. And I thought that all you people that had gone to church had a relationship with God and had a friend and knew what life was all about. And I didn't have that. And I didn't know anything about that. And I discovered alcohol shortly before I went to college. And alcohol made me feel okay. Alcohol made me feel normal. I went to a college that had been a Baptist college originally, and you'd never know it because drinking seemed to be the number one major on campus. And I believed that if I could drink with the best of them, and I could party with the best of them, and do the things I was supposed to do, keeping up my grades just because that was part of the expectation, that I would fit in and I would feel all right and I would be okay and I would learn about what life was all about. I took to booze the way a duck takes to water. Today I believe I was alcoholic from my first drink, although I didn't know that for many, many years afterwards. And the reason I think so is because I needed that booze to make me feel okay. And once I took a drink, I wanted more. And I can remember, even in my freshman year, and I was underage for Ohio, I was 18 at the time, and I was only 17 and a half, that we'd go to this little pub in the next town over, because our county was dry, and you got about five glasses of beer in a pitcher, and there'd be four of us. And I always had to be the one to shoot down the first beer so I could get the last beer in the pitcher, like they're really going to run out at this bar, you know? And that was the way I drank. I had blackouts early on. I never connected that the consequences of the drinking behavior were connected with the alcohol. I had no clue for living. And yet, I was very, very successful outwardly. I graduated from college with two degrees, one in economics and one in history. Went on to graduate school at the University of Chicago to get a master's in business and administration in economics, and I got a good corporate job. I felt that if I worked hard and did all the things I was supposed to do, somehow something would change. But I was always living in the future. You know, if I worked hard enough, I would get enough money to do the things I wanted to do. If I did the things that I was supposed to do on the job, I'd get the promotions. Somehow I would automatically meet the right people, find somebody to love, get married, have children, and all the rest of that stuff. Most of my friends got married out of college. I went to, I think, 11 weddings in 10 weeks after we graduated. And I was the best man twice, in the wedding party two other times, and was always wondering when it was going to be my turn. I thought that by the time I was 30, I needed to be married, have a couple of kids, own a home, be in a job that I liked, and be all set for a nice, safe, and dull, happy life in the suburbs. See, I grew up in an alcoholic home, and I grew up in an apartment building with no yard, and I always thought what they had was better than what I had. Yeah. When I was a kid, I don't know, some of you older guys can remember this, Ozzie and Harriet, the Nelsons, was on television. And I thought this was a great life. I mean, Harriet was always home cooking. Ozzie was always there when the boys were growing up. Ricky Nelson, I liked his music back then. And I thought this was what I wanted. And this was going to be my goal, to have that house in the suburbs. And I didn't care how dull it was, as long as it was safe and secure. Well, I was 3 years sober before I realized that Ozzie didn't have a job. It's not hard to be available to your kids if you don't have a job. But my dad was never available to me because he worked 6 days a week and drank seven. And I missed that, and I missed a lot of things. I always thought you all had the answer to what I was looking for. I didn't grow up planning to become an alcoholic. I certainly didn't want to be like my dad in that respect. But we didn't really know much about alcoholism growing up. Dad never missed a day of work. He'd come home after work, after a couple hours in the bar, and, you know, dinner would be burnt and cold in the back of the stove, and Mom wouldn't say anything. And dinner was pretty silent, and Dad would go watch TV and fall asleep in a chair, and, you know, we'd go off and do our homework and go to school the next day. So I had no idea what a normal family life was like. So when I saw the Nelsons on television, I thought that was pretty cool. You know, here's parents that are talking to their kids, and here's life happening the way it should have been. And that's the kind of person I wanted to be when I grew up. It didn't work out that way. I was sober about a year and a half when I turned 29, and the day after my 29th birthday, I realized I had 364 days to find a woman, marry her, get her pregnant, buy a house, change jobs, get a new car, and move away. There was not a whole lot of sobriety in my thinking. I didn't know how to live. I knew how to do a job. I knew how to pay bills. I'm a financial planner by profession. I knew how to survive functionally in the world, and I drank every night and went to work the next day, just like my daddy did. I did not have a clue about relationships. I did not know how to have a clue about being a person. Big Bert talks about being a friend among friends, man among men. Didn't have a clue. Everything was functional. I knew you because you were on this committee that I was working on for work, or you were on my church committee, or somebody had asked to run a blood drive or some kind of thing. It always had to be related to doing something, because I did not know how to be someone. I always had to be doing. And that's still a disease for me today. That's still part of my problem. You know, spirituality is about being something. You know, we need to divorce ourselves from a lot of the messages we picked up growing up and that we learned to get by in the world and start taking responsibility for who we are, you know. And I never did that, you know. I figured as long as I had a job and paid the bills and gave my 10% to the church, you know, that no matter how miserable my life on earth was, I was going to get reward in heaven. Well, that thinking is somewhat backward, because I found heaven on earth in this program. And that's what we're promised. You know, that's what spirituality is all about. You know, why do we want to get spiritual? We heard it in the promises this morning. All those fears are going to leave us. We're going to make friends. Life is going to be something worth living instead of something we try to endure. And I think for Cliff, it's the getting interest in our fellows. Sorry, Cliff, I couldn't resist that one. But it's because we want those promises, you know. We talk about this program being a program of attraction rather than promotion. That's, you know, in our traditions. Because I want what you people have, you know. I didn't want to live in fear. I didn't want to live in pain. One of the speakers, I think it was last night, talked about hiding under the bed when the phone rang. Well, my first time around this program, I came because I had been arrested for my fourth DUI in 2 years. And in Illinois at the time, it's a lot stricter now, but back then, all they did was take your license away and give you a $1,000 fine plus paying for whatever damage you did. And I was fortunate because I never hurt anybody. I never got into any accidents, and I never maimed anybody, killed anybody, or did any damage to myself or others, at least in the physical sense. My lawyer was a good friend of mine that I'd known in a civic organization for years. He had been telling me that I might have a little bit of problem with alcohol, that I might need to do something, because normal people who drink, you know, anybody can get a DUI, you have a little bit too much coming home from a party or a wedding, but if you're a normal drinker and that happens to you, you used to get supervision, and that would wake people up, you know, and they would stop driving when they drank. When I came into the program, a lady told me that when she was forced with that decision, she made up the sensible choice and she stopped driving. I didn't have that much sense. I kept drinking and driving. And I would wake up in the morning and I would check the car to see if there was blood on the tires. I would check my wallet in the glove compartment to see if there were any tickets. I would see if I had any money left, because I was a blackout drinker and I never knew what happened the night before. And if the car was clean, which it always was, and there were no tickets in the wallet and the money was still there, I'd have a drink and shower and shave and go to work and everything would be fine. A little bit unmanageable, but I didn't know it then because I was going to work. And my father had always gone to work. See, my brother, who's just celebrated 18 years sober last week, turned 43 in the fall, he was a 60s hippie and a drug addict and alcoholic who ran the streets and never held a job and was a real jerk at the time. I thought that's what alcoholics were, because Mark couldn't hold a job. Mark didn't have any responsibility to society or to himself. And the other bums we saw on Skid Row, that was a picture I had, so I had no clue. Because I was always going to work, and I wore a suit and tie, and I was making a nice paycheck, and I was respectable, and nobody knew. But I had my act so much together that after my fourth DUI, my attorney called my father, instead of one of my friends, to come down and get me, and they took the car. And when Jim came to the jail in the little town that I was living in and asked me what was going on, I said, "Jimmy, I need you to arrest my dad for Grand Theft Auto." That was my first thought, because I needed my car to get to work the next day. This was Sunday. The party was Saturday night. I'd get out of jail, I'd get my car, and I'd go to work the next day. And then whatever the fine was going to be, I'd take care of it. I came to this program because I was forced to. My parents took the car. My brother had been back from Germany where he got sober in the army, and he 12-stepped me and took me to a meeting. And I did all the things I was supposed to do. I did these 12 steps in 2 weeks. Nothing but if I'm not efficient, you know. I said I had no problem with the, you know, my life's unmanageable because, you know, you're telling me what I'm supposed to do and I can't do it. I believed in God. I joined a church some years before. Believed in confession. Fine, here's what I did wrong. You know, I don't want to drink anymore. God, you can take care of all this. I didn't think I owed any amends other than a few I'm sorry's, because I always went to work and paid my bills. Didn't have a sponsor at this time either, by the way. I said, I can ask for help in the morning. I pray every day. That's step 11. And, you know, I got active right away in service. I was making coffee at the club when I started. And so I figured I'd done the 12 steps. And we had this meeting at the club. It was run by a group, the only group in the club that actually paid rent that had a home group somewhere else. And it was mostly a bunch of black folks. And the reason I mention that is because I hadn't really had too much to do with black folks in my life before. And I didn't pay any attention to them because they weren't part of my life. But there were these black people that ran these meetings that were sober. And I was told that I should go to this meeting because Millie and George had something to offer. So we were on the 12th step that night, and I was saying how I'd worked all the 12 steps. And you have to picture this club. There's three white boys in this, and about 30 black people, and I was scared because I was prejudiced at the time. You know, I thought that this meant that I was in trouble. Millie Wakefield, she's about 85 now, and she just celebrated her 40th anniversary sober. She's about 4'10", little bitty slip of a thing. But she speaks with power and authority because she worked the steps. And she said to me, she came over and just patted me on the shoulder and said, "That's all right, son, you just sit down." I was very embarrassed, to say the least. But Millie gave me something, and George gave me something, and that group gave me something that I never had before. They gave me acceptance for who I was, something that I was not capable of giving them at the time. They told me that if I just kept coming back, I would be okay. And I did that for about 2 years, and I got my license back, and I got out of all the much of the financial trouble, and got my respectability back, got car insurance, all that stuff, and my job moved, and I moved, and I stopped going to meetings because deep inside of me, I still felt that I was in control and I had the answer. Within 6 months, I was drinking again, daily. And I used to say it would only be a matter of time before I would be drinking and driving again. But the truth of the matter was, I was having my morning drink at 6 o'clock when I was showering. I'd have a tumbler full of bourbon in the shower, you know. I'd just be reaching up and sipping while I'm washing my hair and stuff like that. I had hair back then. That'd be about 6 in the morning. By about 7:30, I'd be on the road. So I used to say that I didn't ever drink and drive my second time around, and the fact of the matter is I was for about 3 months. And the reason I bring up the relapse is because, well, there's two reasons. One, because it's part of my story that I don't want to forget. But it talks to me about compliance versus surrender. When I first came to the program, I didn't have a clue, and I just did what I was told and thinking if I did everything outwardly that you told me to do, everything would change, and I would be okay. When I was back out drinking for 6 months and going to work, I got another promotion, was making more money in my life than I'd ever made. I had no legal difficulties. I had no problems financially or otherwise in my life. I had more people working for me. I had more respect, not because of who I was, which is what I found out later, but because of my position. I had authority over people professionally. And yet I was more miserable inside than I had ever been in my life. And that's one of the reasons why my relapse was important to me, because I found out that just not drinking was not enough. You know, there are a lot of paradoxes in this program, and one of them says, if you bring the body, the mind will follow. And that's true. But if we don't change our thinking, which is what I didn't do, and I stopped bringing the body, nothing changed. If I keep doing the things I used to do, I will drink again. If I keep doing the things you people showed me how to do in this program, I could live a pretty sober life. So relapse was important for me for two reasons. One of them was it showed me that I could have all the outward success and still be miserable. And two, it showed me that I had not grasped any of the spiritual principles of this program. I had worked some outward steps to do the things that I needed to do superficially to fix things, but I had not changed inside. And I needed that because I took care of the outer troubles first, so when I was able to come back to the program, I could work on the inner troubles. But the problem with relapse drinking is there is no guarantee that any of us is going to come back. That's the problem. I had to go out and learn some lessons, and I'm very grateful for that because I came back here. Many people go out to learn those lessons and never make it back. So I have to come to meetings to learn those lessons so I don't have to go back out and do that. I mean, that's for me what's real important. And my relapse didn't happen on January 14th, 1995, when I picked up a drink. It happened the previous April, 9 months before, when I knew that my job was moving and that I would have to find a new place to live and I would have to make new arrangements. When I got to the neighborhood that I was going to live in that was reasonably close to where the new job was and found a nice house, real nice apartment, I didn't call anybody about finding out where meetings were. I didn't feel I needed to because, see, I was treasurer of the club up in Evanston, which is the town just north of Chicago where I got sober with these folks. and figured, well, you know, I got to be there, you know, once a week anyway, and that'll be enough, you know, and I let everybody know I'm still in the program and everything's fine and everything's wonderful. Going to the club once a week to pick up the money and do the financial statements does not qualify as going to an AA meeting. It does not qualify as working any of the steps of the program. So my thinking was not right. It had never been right, and I had never felt like I belonged at all. So when I came back to this program, and I believe it is only by the grace of God that I got back to this program, I woke up one morning in a drunken stupor, as usual, about 5 o'clock, which was my norm. I'd drink till about 2 o'clock when I would pass out, and I'd get up about 5 and watch the farm news and the early weather reports, because they were the only things on TV at the time, while I'm trying to get myself together, looking for that morning drink to keep my hands from shaking so I could shave without cutting my own throat. And had to be early enough so I could shower and shave and the booze could do its work, but I wouldn't be incapacitated going to work. And one morning, I woke up and realized that it didn't have to be that way anymore. And that I could do something about my drinking. Because there are people in Alcoholics Anonymous that were staying sober. So I picked up the phone and I called a friend of mine that was a counselor at Evanston Hospital, where I had been volunteering and helping those poor drunks in my sobriety before, and said to him, Tommy, I need a bed. He said, what's going on? I said, well, I've been drinking for the last 6 months and I need to come in and I think I need some treatment because I need to get away from all the pressures of my life and all this other happy hogwash. He said, well, we'll have something for you. And I called a buddy of mine and said, Eddie, I don't think I'm straight enough to drive and I need you to take me over to the hospital. And he did. And for the first time in my life, I became willing to become teachable. I became willing to listen to somebody else because I knew my way did not work, that I had not got a clue about this. Now, mind you, I was not very willing. I mean, I've got a couple of graduate degrees, and I'm working on another one, and I think I'm a pretty bright guy. And so anything you said, I had to say why or yeah, but, or, you know, prove to me that it works. I don't believe you can be too dumb for this program, but I can believe you can be too smart because I've almost outsmarted myself back into active alcoholism several times on this program, trying to think my way into sober living, which I cannot do. You need to live your way into sober thinking. Keep doing the things that people on this program tell us to do until it becomes a way of life, and then the thinking changes, and then the promises of intuitively knowing how to handle what used to baffle us will happen. It's kind of backwards from what I was taught. I used to try to think my way through every problem, figure it out, and then do it. It doesn't work that way in spirituality, because, see, spirituality has nothing to do with intelligence. It has nothing to do with intellect. It has nothing to do with theology. It has nothing to do with philosophy. It has nothing to do with academics. We can use those tools to help us understand, but that's not where the answers are. Spirituality is about right living. It's about right action. It's about right doing. It's about being in relationship with others. You know, none of us could get sober by ourselves. There might be somebody out there, but I have never found anybody who was truly sober by themselves. See, this program, we have it all over this room, says, we can do what I cannot. Our power to change. You know, the first step is, you know, we. And I never saw that. Somebody said last night, or 2 nights ago, I thought we was 2 me's. Well, you know, I thought I was the Holy Trinity, you know, me, myself, and I, and I'm going to figure this all out. And the committee in my head, in active alcoholism and early recovery, did not have a clue. And that's part of the problem. If you don't know anything, talking to yourself is not going to add any wisdom. And I didn't know anything about relationships. I didn't know how you went about changing and getting along with people because I was seeing everything in black and white and functional terms. I had to find somebody that could teach me and I had to become open-minded. And that's very difficult for me, sometimes even today, to be willing to listen, because like everybody else, I filter everything I hear through my own head, through my own perceptions, and through my own beliefs. And there's nothing wrong with that to a point, as long as I'm willing to try to put myself in your shoes and hear what you have to say, rather than close myself off to anything that doesn't agree with my pet notions of reality. And, you know, we had this meeting last night at the bonfire, and people were talking about their conception of God and their understanding of spirituality, and I thought to myself, there is more than one way to the top of the mountain. There is more than one way to find God. And when I get a resentment because I don't think you're doing it the right way, or you're not doing it my way, well, what does the big book tell me about that? But if I'm upset about something, then there is something wrong with me, not with you. So if I have a resentment about it, then I need to look at me, not tell you how you have to fix your life. But that was the way I operated for many, many years and still do on occasion. Arrogance, self-righteousness, self-centeredness, those are three of the demons that plagued me all my life. And the big book talks about that to me. You know, it says that selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of all my problems. And that if I want to get sober, I need to change that. I need to learn how to get outside of myself and stop putting myself in charge of everything. And that's page 60, right after How It Works. I didn't know how to do that because I grew up in a culture that suggested that the way to success was to get everything you want and get it now, and heck with everybody else. And if something bad happened to me, it was somebody else's fault. And they would have to pay for it one way or the other. The only reason that I was doing a lot of the things I did in the church and the community was to buy some points with God and to make other people respect me. Because I had no self-esteem. I had no internal sense of I was anybody worth anything. But if I did all these things, it would prove to you that I was a good person, that I had something to offer, and you would, if not like me, at least respect me and understand that I was somebody. That doesn't work in my life today. When I'm into that type of behavior, which still happens, I want to be liked, I want to be respected. But then I'm into myself again. And I've got to learn to do things for the right reasons, so that they flow out of love and not out of self-centeredness. We only get sober to be of maximum service to ourselves, to God, and to others. It's in step 7. That was not a philosophy that I really had any desire to embrace, because I've always asked, what's in it for me? And if I was busy doing service work and being selfless and trying to make life comfortable for everybody else, it was because if I did that, you would think I was a great guy. And you would be grateful, and you would tell me what a wonderful person I was, and I would get self-esteem that way. You can work yourself to death trying to do that, you know. One of the spiritual principles of my faith is that we have to love our neighbors as ourselves, but kind of a prerequisite then is that we have to love ourselves. I cannot love you if I don't have any love for myself, because all I'm doing then is trying to get you to love me and prove that I'm okay. I can do nice things, and I can help you out, and those acts in of themselves are fine and good, and your life will be better for them. You know, I've been a foster parent to kids in the Philippines for probably 15 years because I thought that was the thing I was supposed to do. And those kids' lives are better because of that, financially. But I was probably 8 years or 9 years sober before I ever wrote a personal letter to any one of those kids. And I found out that somebody in the office in Rhode Island was writing those letters for me, so those kids had some feeling that there was a foster parent in the United States somewhere that cared about them. And all I was doing was sending checks, because that's how you do things. I mean, it's easy, write a check to charity. I don't feel guilty about that today, because that's just a lesson that I had to learn. And I was not ready to hear it when I was newly sober. But those acts of kindness were not motivated, or only partially motivated by kindness. They do some good in the world, but they didn't do me any good, because I was still trying to buy salvation out there somewhere. Salvation is not out there. Salvation is in here, and it's in here, and it's inside each one of you. You know, there's a real tension in Christianity, which is my faith, which a lot of the principles in this program come from, because we think there is the second coming and there's this kingdom of heaven beyond. And I believe there is, but Jesus talks about building the kingdom of heaven on earth, and how do you do that? But you take care of your neighbors. You know, we build that kingdom on earth every meeting we go to, every time we share with another alcoholic, whether it's in these rooms or in a detox center or wherever we're volunteering. We are creating that kingdom of heaven. We are sharing what we have found, and we are providing salvation. You know, I was in the bondage of alcoholism, slave to booze. I had no other higher power for many years in my life, because I had no choice. When I decided that I needed to stop drinking, because drinking was interfering with my other goals in life, I found that I could not stop drinking. Alcohol had become a power greater than myself. And I believe that just like Moses led the Israelites across the Red Sea out of bondage into Egypt, out of bondage from Egypt, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous has led me out of the Egypt of enslavement to alcohol and into the promised land, which is a life of sobriety. So, I didn't see God coming down in a pillar of fire, parting the Red Sea and drowning all the charioteers and all the soldiers of the Pharaoh so that the Israelites could walk across on dry land. That's not the way God worked in my life. God showed up when somebody said to me, if you come to a meeting with us, you will never have to drink again. That was a promise of salvation. And that is true. Even though I had to go back out for a few months in 1985, nobody in this room needs to go back out there to find out what those lessons are. And the sad truth is that many, many folks in this fellowship will die drunk because they need to go do more research and don't find their way back. I've been given that gift twice to find my way into these rooms. I know there's another drunk in me, but I don't know if I'm going to get a third chance in this program. And that thought scares me sometimes. And rightly it should. There is a healthy component to fear. No matter how spiritual I am, if I put my hand on a hot stove, I am going to get burned. If I go out and drink, there is a pretty good chance, based on my track record, that I will get drunk again. And when I get drunk, I have no clue what I'm going to do next. So I believe the most spiritual thing that I can do today is not take a drink. If I do not take a drink, then no matter what happens in my day, no matter what problems I think I have a chance to find a solution. Because when I don't drink, I have some use of my mental faculties that can say to me, I'm having a problem. I think I know some people who have a solution. And I can find that in a meeting. I can talk to my sponsor. I can talk to my brother today. I can talk to a lot of friends on the program. And I can talk to a lot of spiritual people outside this program who I've met, who have found some of the tools we have in their own lives, even though they don't need this fellowship. Because the big book tells me that I need to be open to what other people have to offer. Doctors, psychiatrists, people of religion. Because everybody who is sincerely trying to do the best they can, people that are coming to these rooms, the people that are going to church or whatever, just that are trying to do the best they can, are already spiritual. We just need to develop the tools to live it out. We get those tools in the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We get those tools in the big book, in the literature. We get those tools when we share with people who have recovered. We get those tools when we find other people who have answers, whether it's through spiritual reading or through church or through whatever you wherever you find that help. It is there for us if we're open to it. And I found a great deal of comfort in that, because I know today that if I am not teachable, if I am closing my mind, shutting the door to your experience, your strength, and your hope, I am cheating myself and missing the answers that I may need when I'm out there tomorrow trying to figure out how to live sober. So I have to change. I have to change my closed-mindedness, my self-centeredness, my arrogance, my self-righteousness, and my prejudice to openness, honesty, and willingness. And I don't know how to do that by myself. And I don't think that I would have the courage to even attempt that if I had not found love and acceptance in these rooms. My sponsor used to say, you can get sober on the fellowship, but sooner or later you have to start working the steps if you want to stay sober. And I believe that. But I would not have had the courage to even start to look at myself if I had not already found love and acceptance in these rooms. And I think that's one of the hardest things for us, to accept the fact that we are accepted, to accept the fact that we are loved. Not because I make so much money or I have this kind of house where I can do these things for you, but I am accepted and loved because I am an alcoholic in these rooms. And people, when I first came around, and for a great number of years thereafter, told me that I was a good person, that in spite of who I thought I was and what I may have done, I was a good person. And that's true for everybody in this room. I believe that we are all born and made in the image and likeness of God, a loving creator who cares very much for us. And I believe that the goal of spirituality, the journey, is how to grow in that image and likeness. And God gives us each other to help us do that. We say the Lord's Prayer at the end of every meeting, just about everywhere I've been. And it starts out with Our Father. Oliver Wendell Holmes was the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in the last century. He used to say his entire religion was summed up in the first two words of the Lord's Prayer. Because once you say Our, you're talking about us. And once you say Father, that means everybody's a brother and sister. Which means there is no room for exclusion. There is no room for judgment. There is no room for prejudice. There is no room for moralism. There is no room for conditional friendship. But how would you like it if your sponsor said, I will be your sponsor and your friend as long as you do exactly what I tell you when I tell you, and if you don't, I'm out of here. I've never had a sponsor say that to me. I've had sponsors call me on inappropriate behavior, but they have never said, I'm out of here because you're not worth it. I'm out of here because your behavior is inappropriate, which makes you a bad person. We need to separate the negative messages we grew up with that says, when I do something wrong, I am something wrong. If I make a mistake, I am a mistake. If I get in trouble, it's because I am trouble. my roommate in the treatment center had a little picture of a kid in a high chair with a dumped up bowl of spaghetti on his head, and he looked like a total mess, and it said, "God don't make no junk." And many, many times, many, many years in my life, I have felt like that kid being a total mess, and I thought I was a piece of junk. If you only knew me, if you only knew what it was like on the inside, you would go running and screaming in the opposite direction, because you would know what a loser I was, and you wouldn't want to know me. And that is a very negative and very damaging message that I heard. I don't know if anybody said it to me, but that's what I heard. And I think a lot of us hear that. I think kids, the first word they learn is no. You know, don't do that. You can control people for a while through fear, and that makes it easy. But it sends a message of conditional love. And one of the messages I received, even though I know my parents didn't intend to give it to me, was, we will love you as long as you get straight A's. We will love you as long as you get into the college and graduate school that we think is worthy. My parents were both teachers, both academically oriented, and they wanted success for their children. And they believed that success came through education and a good paying job that gave them the security that they received from the Depression. Both my parents were the first in their families to go to college. And their families, my uncles and my aunts, are very, very proud of my parents and very, very proud of myself and my brothers, because none of my cousins have gone to college. Some of them are a great deal happier than we are. But you see, it wasn't my parents' fault, because that was the values they learned, because that was the tools that they learned in the Depression, were how you get ahead and how you keep the wolf from the door. So there was a great deal of push in my family to get education. And as long as I was doing what my parents want, I stayed out of trouble. I got a decent home and roof, and I got some acceptance. And I also didn't have to take any responsibility for my life.